All this week, we've been talking about various facets of immigration history and policies in the United States. Today, we wanted to take a look at refugee resettlement and why people fleeing violence and political persecution look to the U.S. for hope. Between October 2016 and September 2017, the United States took in nearly 54,000 refugees, according to the United Nations Human Rights Council. Nearly 40% of those admitted to the U.S. came from the Near East and South Asia. And in 2017, Wisconsin welcomed 585 refugees. The number of refugees being admitted into the United States on the whole is on the decline, and a lot of factors play into which refugees are resettled in the U.S. Our next guest is here to talk about why we're seeing a drop in refugees being allowed to come into the U.S. and how the United States has responded to those seeking asylum over the years. Elise Cohn is an assistant professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin-Sheboygan and UW-Manitowoc. Elise, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks so much, Judith. Glad to be with you.
Well, I'm so glad you're with us because there are so many different issues here, and one of the issues is the basic terms. What are we talking about when we talk about someone who is a refugee?
That is a great question to get the conversation started. There are several requirements, things that kind of distinguish a refugee from other types of migrants that you've been talking about on your series this week. So first of all, the refugee needs to be forcibly displaced as opposed to a voluntary migrant who may be seeking better economic opportunities, family reunification, education opportunities. Those would not meet the criteria for being considered a refugee. Second, we have this very strict legal definition that U.S. law follows, and we also have in international treaties, that the refugee must be fleeing due to a well-founded fear of persecution. So this can be based on their race, religion, nationality, their political opinion, or even something like their social group within the society. But if it's something like a natural disaster, for example, that would not meet that criteria, and they would need to seek some other kind of humanitarian relief. And then the final thing is they need to be outside the borders of their home territory. So like internally displaced people that may still be in the country, to be a refugee, they must have crossed some internationally recognized sovereign border.
And who determines whether an individual or a group of people have met the criteria of being, you know, forcibly removed? Who decides that?
Oh, yeah. And another really key point of all of this is the United Nations, the refugee agency, the UNHCR, they are the ones that will officially register refugees. For the case of the United States, we actually only tend to accept refugees who have already been registered officially with the UNHCR, and the UNHCR has sort of determined they do indeed meet those criteria. Of course, then for our country, we put them through a whole separate screening and vetting process for our own interview processes and security concerns.
Now, another term that we hear is asylum seeker. And how do people who are considered asylum seekers compare to people who are considered refugees?
Oh, yeah, another really good angle here. Asylum seekers are pursuing refugee status, but they have not yet been officially granted that status. In the U.S., we also have this interesting phenomenon where we call people that are already on our territory asking to be considered refugees and sort of pursuing asylum claims. We call them asylees, and we only call people refugees who we are receiving from other countries overseas that have already been registered with the UNHCR.
Well, now that we've got some of the basic terminology down, Elise, how welcoming has the United States been historically towards refugees?
Yeah, so we have this really fascinating foreign policy where our refugee inflows have been shaped a lot by our communist, sort of anti-communist Cold War era. So for a long time, we were very welcoming to, for example, Hungarians and Cubans fleeing communism. We used it as part of our kind of political propaganda that those people were voting against communism with their feet by choosing to leave and wanting to come to the U.S. for refuge. In the 1970s and 80s, we took in a lot of people from Vietnam, Cambodia, Laos as refugees, acknowledging our own culpability stability in the Indochina, as it was called then, or, you know, Vietnam War situation. So this is something where over time, a lot of it has been shaped by our political interests and our involvement overseas. But certainly in terms of raw numbers, we have taken in the greatest share over the years in the number of refugees per capita, not as much as some other countries that have done a bit more in terms of their smaller populations. But when you just look at the raw numbers, we have been very welcoming.
And according to the United Nations Human Rights Council, the U.S. has admitted about 3 million refugees since 1975.
Yeah, so again, when you look at those raw numbers and we look at our foreign policy interests of why we accepted those different groups, you can say that we've seen maybe something like an average of 70 to 80,000 refugees per year coming into the U.S. So for a long time, that was sort of the normal, quote, normal, if you can say that, in terms of our ceiling that we established for how many refugees we would admit every year.
We're talking with Elise Cohen. She's an assistant professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin-Sheboygan and at UW-Manitowoc. And we're looking specifically as part of our series on immigration this week. We're looking at refugees and asylum status in the United States, trends and policies. And Elise, I was interested to find out that that refugees don't necessarily seek refugee status or resettlement in a particular country, they aren't able to choose. Is that correct?
Right. So one of the things that happens once the refugee is sort of qualified by the UNHCR and registered with the UNHCR, a very limited number of them will be considered for what's called third country resettlement. It's something like on average, less than 1% of the world's refugees. And right now, we're talking about 25 million refugees. We're kind of at a record high of global displacement, and that includes refugees. So less than 1% of those will actually be resettled in a third country. A lot of them will end up being locally integrated in whichever country they initially fled to, unfortunately, the case is increasingly common where they will languish in what's supposed to be temporary refugee camps, but they may end up being there, you know, upwards of 15, 20, 25 years.
Is it a requirement of member states of the United Nations to accept refugees, or how do countries become countries that do accept them?
Oh, this is probably the key debate and issue for those that work on refugee issues, is we do not have any clear mechanisms of how the responsibility to protect refugees should be allocated. So there's this very sort of vague language in our refugee convention and other international laws and norms that, you know, all countries in the spirit of cooperation should be contributing. We have seen proposals for quotas in the past, but they inevitably failed, and countries did not want to commit to taking a certain number. So what we've seen is kind of like an ad hoc basis based on the political interests or maybe the domestic politics in those countries at the time. Each country sort of responds to each refugee crisis in its own distinct way.
But it sounds like if a country, the U.S. or another country, decided that they no longer were open to accepting refugees, they could make that decision.
Yes, you're absolutely right. We do have some international legal requirements from the Refugee Convention, and the United States is a party to that, so we're bound by that. We can't send someone away back to a territory where they would face harm, persecution, or torture. It's called the prohibition on non-refoulement, which means returning. So the prohibition of returning someone back to that territory. And we have sort of circumvented that sometimes. There are those legal scholars that say that also means we should not be frustrating the attempt for people to seek asylum. And the Universal Declaration of Human Rights says that is a basic fundamental human right, is people should be able to leave the territory where they are being harmed and get refuge somewhere else. But you're picking up on the sort of paradox or the tension where there's no positive obligation that countries must take into their territory a certain number of refugees. And that's where we see the responsibility sharing sort of collapsing. For example, right now, a lot of people have looked, and a lot of countries have looked to the U.S. as a leader in the refugee responsibility sharing. And now that we've sort of departed from that and are moving away from that, it makes it easier for other countries to follow suit.
As we've said, refugees are in a very different situation than other types of immigrants. What support and systems are in place if they are resettled in the United States?
Oh, yeah, that's another really great question. We have a lot of bureaucracy built around this. So first of all, the president is supposed to consult with Congress every year to come up with what our annual cap will be for the following fiscal year. There was a little bit of controversy in the fall, as some people listening may remember, because the Trump administration didn't really consult with Congress. It just sort of came up with the lowered cap for fiscal year 2018 and then informed Congress, you know, this is what we're doing. But the way it's supposed to work is the legislative branch is consulted. And then all of these agencies in the State Department, Health and Human Services, Department of Homeland Security, really work together. And these agencies are crucial in the kinds of services that you're talking about: English language training, employment support. Of course, before they are even allowed in the country, they go through a very heavy security vetting process that usually takes about 2 years. Now it seems like it will be taking even much longer, because of the new vetting requirements, of course, and medical screenings, cultural orientations. So after they've gone through all of that and they've arrived, that's when the local NGOs, a lot of faith-based community organizations, for example, are really crucial partners in helping them get settled in local communities around the country.
I believe the cap that was set for fiscal year 2016 was 85,000. How much was that cap lowered for fiscal year 2018?
Yeah, so that's where we saw some controversy and some debates kind of blossoming in our own domestic politics about refugee responsibility sharing. It was lowered to 45,000 for fiscal year 2018. The people looking at the numbers, though, because of the travel ban's lingering effects and because of the new enhanced vetting for a list of, like, you know, 10 or 11 countries, they're saying it's really more like we're going to end up somewhere around 20,000, 25,000. So we haven't been that low since the immediate aftermath of 9/11, when we kind of overhauled everything, created a whole new Department of Homeland Security. Even then, though, our cap was not lowered officially. Our cap was still at about 70,000. So we haven't had a cap this low since the invention of our refugee resettlement program in 1980.
We're talking right now with Elise Cohen. She's an assistant professor of political science at UW-Sheboygan and UW-Manitowoc. She's with us to talk about refugee resettlement in the United States and the limits put on those coming to the U.S. seeking either refugee status or asylum. And we're taking your questions now at 800-642-1234. What do you want to know about refugee resettlement in the United States or Wisconsin? What's confusing about the process? How do you think the United States handles refugees and similar issues? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. This is Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Right now, we're continuing our conversation about refugees in the United States as part of our series this week, Exploring Immigration. Our guest is Elise Cohen. She's an assistant professor of political science at UW-Sheboygan and UW-Manitowoc, and much of her research explores policies regulating refugees in the U.S. And you can call in at 800-642-1234. Do you think we should be accepting more or fewer refugees? And if you're a refugee who now lives in the United States, we'd like to hear your story. Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. And Elise, we have Scott in Luxembourg, Wisconsin on the line. Let's go there. Hi, Scott.
Hello.
Hi, what's your question?
I was talking with some friends this weekend about refugee resettlement, and one of them had commented that they didn't want to pay for the refugee resettlement, which made me wonder, how much does it cost the individual American taxpayer for our refugee resettlement? program?
That's a great question, Scott. So, Elise, what kind of costs are involved, first of all, in resettlement of a refugee, and where does that money come from?
Yeah, that's a really great question. A lot of people ask that, and it ends up being very prominent in the debate over how many and is there sort of too much in terms of the strain it may put on our economy. First thing to think about for refugee resettlement is across all these different agencies, that is going to come from the annual budget appropriations. But then for the Department of Homeland Security and all of that vetting and screening, that actually is funded through the fees that the Immigrations and Citizenship Office already has people paying for their application. So some of that ends up funding itself. The other thing to keep in mind that sort of shocks people with our refugee policy is they are responsible for paying even their own airfare, any sort of travel costs accrued with coming here. There's actually a whole sort of refugee debt program where they repay debt because they take out loans, and a lot of that funding just from the interest on the debt goes directly back into the refugee resettlement, so they end up making some money to fund themselves just off of the loans they give refugees that they then must pay back. All of the studies that we have in terms of the economic impact, it ends up being, you know, how you measure it. And once you take it over 5 years, that's when you see the cost that your caller is talking about, the sort of social services expenditures, they start to diminish. Some of the studies that we have that go even broader, like maybe 15, 20 years down the road, they find the net impact tends to be contributing more to the economy. So a lot of refugees are entrepreneurial, may start businesses, create jobs in their local communities. Of course, refugees, like all other categories of legal immigrants, are paying taxes, so they end up contributing to the tax revenue base. So again, there's no perfect and magic answer because there's a lot of different indicators you can look at for the economy. But what we can say sort of across all of these studies is once you go over 5 years, we tend to see that it's a net positive contribution into the host country's economy.
Scott, thanks for that call. And Elise, one of the issues that you study that really comes into this discussion is nativism. Can you briefly explain that concept for us?
Oh, yeah, that's one that I've been looking at a lot in my research, my current book project as well. So first of all, just to define it, because I'm not sure how many listeners have heard of the term, nativism is sort of a defensive nationalism. So we're thinking about viewing foreigners as threatening, somehow a possibly a threat or danger to the American way of life. So we've seen this, you know, from the very beginning of our country's sovereignty, that we always had the sort of tendency to view foreigners with a fear, maybe even hostility. And it has heavily shaped our immigration policy. And I think some of your other programs this week have, you know, talked about the Asian exclusionary policies and Japanese internment. What I'm looking at with the Syrian refugee crisis, it's really interesting where we see an overlap of when the Syrian refugee crisis got politicized. You know, think back to a little bit before the 2016 elections, especially in 2015, we saw the Syrian refugee crisis became incredibly politicized in our own domestic politics. And around that time that we see this very anti-Syrian refugee, sort of anti-immigrant language, a nativist language, start to be prominent again in our political discussion, the FBI finds a rise in hate crimes against people that are perceived to be Muslim. Listeners may remember a couple of sort of famous stories of what I would actually call nativist violence from last year. There was a violent physical attack in Oregon. A man working in a Middle Eastern restaurant was beaten with a pipe while being called a terrorist and told to, quote, get out of America. And around the same time in March of last year, a Florida man set fire to a convenience store that he mistakenly believed was Muslim-owned. And he said the reason he did that is he wanted to, quote, do his part to run the Arabs out of our country. So what I found in my research is there is clearly a relationship between how our policymakers and members of the public are thinking about refugee policy and a sort of persistent nativism that we have within our own society, where Muslims and Middle Easterners are viewed as, you know, foreigners who don't really belong and they're not real Americans.
But what's interesting to me, Elise, is that this is a time where the numbers are dropping pretty rapidly of how many people are being admitted to the U.S., but the rhetoric isn't necessarily going down along with it. It sounds like actually the rhetoric is ramping up.
Oh, yeah, that's a great observation. So, you know, what we find in political science research is we have these things called partisan cues where people will take messages from leaders in their political party, right? So if we think about maybe, you know, some officials in the Trump administration who are Republican and some Americans who identify strongly as, you know, Republicans, and they hear those messages surrounding, well, we're going to cut the cap to the lowest it's ever been, and here's why that's a good thing. They take those cues from those leaders in their party, and they start thinking about and talking about refugee responsibility sharing in a way that sort of fits with what they're hearing, those messages that, well, you know, refugees are, maybe they're a drag on the economy, or maybe we need to put our own people always first and not take any of these refugees, or maybe they're terrorists or criminals. And so that's a really fascinating thing when we start to look at what's being said. As you pointed out, it ends up being very prominent, even as the numbers are dropping, to kind of justify, and that's why we're doing the right thing by drastically cutting back on our refugee admissions.
Well, Elise, thank you so much to get through, and you really helped to clarify a lot of pretty confusing issues. So thanks so much for your time.
Thank you. Glad to be with you.
Elise Cohn is an assistant professor of political science at UW-Sheboygan and UW-Manitowoc. She joined us today to talk about the experience of refugees and asylum seekers in the United States as part of our series this week, Looking at Immigration in America. You can listen to past interviews in our immigration series online at WPR.org/Central Time. And tomorrow we'll talk to an immigration attorney about the challenges facing unaccompanied immigrant children in the U.S. legal system.